The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Hi, everybody. Coming up, Nicole tells your fortune looking ahead. So get out your crystal and stay tuned with Mistress Nicole. All dressed in leather, you won't forget her. You want to love her and you won't let go. Who's that woman, crazy woman, Nicole?
All right. I thought we needed to get started on sort of a subversive note. So there's the Chris Isaac intro for you. Welcome to a Monday. I am Nicole Sandler. I hope you had a great weekend. I hope you stayed safe, stayed in, got vaccinated if you weren't already. So today is a really busy show. Let me just tell you, I sort of overdid it. Remember last week we were supposed to talk to Julie K. Brown of the Miami Herald, the one who broke the Jeffrey Epstein story. She's got the new book out, Perversion of Justice. Well, she's going to join us at the bottom of the hour. So we're going to go from one very important story with horrific implications, but delivered in a kind of a humorous way, to another horrific story with even worse implications that is not funny at all. So we're gonna run both ends of the extreme here. But you may recall, I think it was last week, maybe the week before, I discovered this video of this guy on YouTube explaining exactly why he got the vaccine and why you should. And I played the video for you and you guys reacted the same way I did, that was pretty amazing. So I thought what we'd do before we talk to Drew himself, yes, he joins us in just a couple of minutes, is play the video again for those of you who did not see it the first time or haven't seen it yet or just need to see it again because he packs a whole lot into 2.5 minutes and it goes by quickly and old people like me is like, what did he say there? So let's share it again. And on the other side, we'll talk to Drew, but I want you to hear his brilliant words of wisdom. Take it away. Drew comments.
150 million full vaccinations given out in the U.S., and I'm one of them. Moderna gang, my boy. Why'd I do it? Pretty simple. Deadly pandemic. I ain't trying to die. Vaccine, 94% effective after the second shot. Sign me up. After hearing from virologists and ICU physicians, most of whom look like me, my mind was made up. Not to mention, nobody give me a good enough reason not to do it. You don't remember Tuskegee, my boy? Yeah, I do, and I also remember in that same instance, black men were refused treatment. Matter of fact, we're routinely excluded or hindered from getting life-saving vaccinations. But look how fast they made it. They didn't test it. That's cap. First off, they started phase one of human trials for Moderna back in mid-March 2020. Plus, three things contribute to vaccine development usually taking so long. Funding, manpower, when the starting point is. Now, coincidentally, these are the same factors that go into dating, but that's a conversation for another time. Let's first look at funding. Medical research costs money. Most of the time, one of the biggest challenges is getting grants. But that wasn't the case this time around. With the exception of the state of Georgia, the whole world closed down and researchers had access to all the money in it, which leads into the next advantage they had. Incredible manpower. Usually, these research groups are pretty small with a handful of folks. But COVID-19 taking top priority in the world, the entire global medical community researched it too. Together at the same time and shared notes. That with 100,000 people pretty much immediately volunteering for trials, they had more manpower than the comment section of a Kevin Samuels video. Anyway, third part is your starting point. mRNA is new, but it ain't that new. It's been studied for the better part of 30 years, going back to the early 90s. I'm talking about days of Mama Said Knock You Out, LL, Wanted Dead or Alive, Fuji Rap, Home Base, DJ Jazzy Jeff, and The Fresh Print. Some of y'all too young for that. Technically, I am too. But you don't even know what's in that vaccine. And it be causing Bell's palsy and autism and making women infertile and having miscarriages. Big Cap, New Era Cap, Michelin Ness. In my Moderna vaccine was messenger ribonucleic acid, lipid nanoparticles such as SM102, polyethylene glycol 2000 dimeristoyl glycerol, cholesterol, and 1,2 distilroyl SN-glycerol-3-phosphocholine, trimethamine, trimethamine hydrochloride, acetic acid, sodium acetate trihydrate, and sucrose.
Bruh.
Ain't none of that causing Bell's palsy, autism, or infertility in women. Vaccinated women have later become pregnant. Women who didn't know they were pregnant when they got vaccinated went full term with their gestation. Look, this is how they work. The mRNA goes into the cytoplasm of the cell and gives instructions on how to make the spike protein found on the actual COVID-19 virus. Your own body creates the spike protein, then creates antibodies that can beat it when and if the real thing shows up. So in athlete terms, the mRNA shows up with game film. Your body then creates a scout team and can strategize against and beat up on in preparation for game day, just in case there's a game day. So really, we ain't even talking about vaccination.
We talking about practice.
Ooh.
As with any vaccinations, there are minor risks. So talk to your doctor. They're going to tell you the same thing. Then go get your shot. Because it don't make sense to be more afraid of the vaccine than you are of the actual virus. That's Bass Ackwards.
That is Bass Ackwards. All right. That is. Whoa. And I pulled down the wrong pot. That is Drew Commons, and he joins us now on the show. Drew, first of all, wow, thank you. And from a fellow member of the Moderna Club or gang, good on you. That was awesome. That was just so good. And I'm coming to you from South Florida. We are. Where is it? Oh, I've got it for you right here. We are.
We're number one, damn it.
Florida. Yeah, or Florida, as I call it. So, Drew, first of all, welcome to the show. That was awesome. Thank you for doing that. What prompted you to make that video?
Oh, well, thank you for having me, first and foremost. I really appreciate it here. What prompted me was just the amount of misinformation that I saw on social media, honestly and truly. Had it not been a bunch of misinformation, I probably would not have gone and done the video. So, really, you know, I took some time. And when I say some time, I'm talking about maybe around 4 months or so to really study and get educated. This wasn't a 10-minute Google search. This wasn't something that I did, you know, oh, I did 30 minutes. I've done research. Like, no, I was able to take advantage of certain resources because I had questions. You know, I have underlying conditions. I'm an asthmatic. I have a younger brother who's asthmatic. I have parents in their mid-60s with underlying conditions as well. And I wanted to be able to have conversations with them, with friends, with old teammates from college, whatever it is that I could, you know, and hopefully have those conversations informed. And so that's what happened. I took advantage of Clubhouse, the app Clubhouse, was in rooms with cardiologists, immunologists, epidemiologists, some of those practices I didn't even know were that specific. But I was able to ask questions. Rarely, sometimes I couldn't get on stage, but other people were able to go up there and ask questions that maybe I didn't even think of. And I was able to take notes. And then, you know, those doctors would point you in the right direction for other resources to make sure you're able to better inform yourself. And so, once I realized, you know, that these vaccines were pretty safe and I kind of got the gist of it, I was like, you know what? And just, again, the misinformation was so thick that I was like, yeah, I need to say something.
And it's great. You obviously did your homework. You knew what you were talking about. You threw out fact after fact after fact at a very high speed pace, which was great. I had to go back and listen a few times because I'm old like your parents. But God, it was awesome. And I love that you put, you know, when you said no one knows what's in it, and then you reeled off the ingredients or what's in it, and you put those at the bottom. My only thing for old people like me would be, you know, write out the captions at the bottom so we can read along with you, because there's a lot of good information there. I also noticed, I put on the Chiron YouTuber Drew Commons. You're more than a YouTuber. You're a social media commenter. You're on Instagram and you're on TikTok and on YouTube, but you have different handles in different places. So it took a while to track you down. I noticed on Twitter, which is where I hang out a lot, you are SJS856. And the other thing that I noticed is that you are really good at answering people's questions, because a lot of people are coming at you with, hey man, this is awesome, but others are challenging you and you're answering back because you're really performing a public service here.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I try to be good at answering the question. I think it's easy to answer questions when you know what you're talking about, when you've done your homework. So you can ask me a question about, at this point, COVID-19 or the vaccination process. You can ask me a question about, and I can give you at least an educated or somewhat informed answer. You can ask me about football. I'll give you a very informed answer. You can ask me about politics. You can ask about Kamala Harris. I can give you an extremely informed answer. And so you can ask me about North Carolina A&T. I'll talk to you all day long. So, yeah.
Nice. Now on YouTube, you are under Drew Commons. It's not a uniform name, but I'll put a couple of different links on the blog today so people can find you on the various different social media networks. Now, you mentioned Kamala Harris, and I've noticed you've recorded a number of videos about her. A year ago, you have one called No Proof Kamala Harris Locked Up Black Men. So you were pushing back against all the anti-Kamala stuff that was out there, and there's a lot of it out there.
Well, yeah, that's actually kind of what birthed the entire need to go ahead and push back against misinformation. Back at like towards the end of 2018, maybe very, very beginning of 2019. The end of 2018. I had the inkling that she would be running for president, but I wanted my reason for supporting her to be more than, oh, she's a black woman and went to an HBCU. Great. That's a good reason. But I want to be able to have a conversation of substance to somebody. So I took time, when I say so much time, researching her record, going back, not just contemporary articles written within the last 3 years. I'm talking about I was digging back to 2003, 2000, year 2000, 99, like try to go back even to 1990 just to find things and such. And then from that, I was able to come across some other people who were also researching as well. And then what happened was when the smears came out and things, I was like, wait a minute, this does not line up with what I was researching. And they were talking about things that I'd already looked at. I'm like, no, that's wrong, because I have the information right here. And I said, wait, you're leaving this part out. And so it took me a while, but around September 2019, I was like, okay, you know what? I can't comment on Twitter and beat all these bots and troll and folk coming at me, because it's like hundreds of people coming at you from all directions. And so I was like, I tell you what, I feel like I create content as well as, if not better than most folks. So let me go ahead and create content. So my video will do the work. And I created something that the, you know, the bots and trolls couldn't really compete with. That was called, I looked up Kamala Harris, and that took off. I was able to really, you know, make some connections from that. And that kind of just spurred that in energy and say, hold up, when I see something that's wrong and I have the ability to research it, I'm going to say something back.
Great. And that's what we should all be doing. Enough of the misinformation. Let's get out good information and do it in a fun way, which is what I try to do, what you definitely are successful at. Drew, I got to ask you, my husband just stuck his head in the room. He's a former sports agent. And he said, what did he play and where?
I played strong safety and special teams at North Carolina A&T State University. Aggie Pride in Greensboro, North Carolina, largest HBCU in the country.
Oh, nice. And now, so what do you do for a living? I mean, I love your videos, but I'm guessing they don't pay the bills.
These right now they don't. This is a hobby. However, you know, opportunities do present themselves and that sort of thing. Right now I'm in corporate America. So I'm in the, well, prior to the pandemic, it was a suit and tie every single day. And then once, you know, obviously everything started happening, it was a remote situation working from home. So I'm a corporate guy at this point.
Oh, boy. Now you're not in North Carolina anymore, because I know you're on the West Coast. No,
that's right. I'm in Los Angeles, California. That's great.
My old stomping. I lived in LA for 15 years and I miss it. I worked in radio in Los Angeles for 15 years back. I'm old. I'm, you know, like your parents' age, but, no, I did from 1987 to 2000-ish is when I left. Okay. LA is great, but it's a different world out there. Now I know, mask mandate back in effect in LA. Are you out and about, or how has the new COVID wave affected you?
I'll be honest with you. I try to stay in the house as much as possible. You know, unless I'm going to the gym, I'm a LA fitness guy, so I'll be there. But you know, even in my building, we have a gym downstairs. If I don't want to make it out to the actual weight room out there, which is, I get good work done. But if I'm not going to the supermarket, you know, it's rare you're going to find me out. But when I'm out, I do wear my mask. But, you know, I stay in the house. You know, I have a PlayStation. I got Netflix, Hulu.
What more do you need? You got the
Amazon
internet,
Prime,
right?
We're good. Yeah, exactly. Internet, we're good.
You're awesome. I hope you make more videos, because I noticed you did them for a while and then you sort of backed off. But this was brilliant. And I know I'm not the only one who thinks it, because I'm seeing how it's going viral. Like I said, I saw it last week and I was like, what was that? Wait a minute, I got to listen to that again. And I backed it up and then I played it on my show and the listeners agreed. So that's why I reached out. I just had to find you and invite you on and say thank you for doing that, because there are never enough ways to say it. People need to understand. And, you know, check this out. I'm a lung cancer survivor. I'm walking around with missing basically my left lung. So although I'm not immunocompromised or anything, I'm at risk. And, so I'm glad to hear people are being responsible. It's not just about, not talking to you. It's not about you. It's not about the person who puts on the mask. It's about the other people. You don't know what their situation is, and you could be saving their lives by wearing a mask so you don't spread the fucking virus.
Facts. That's big facts. And that's really one of the motivators behind it. Like, obviously, yeah, my own self-preservation, that's important, but what's also important is your fellow person out there. And so, you know, if you can not be, you know, you have to look at it like this. Any unvaccinated body is a potential hub for a new variant. And so one of the things I don't want to contribute to is someone else having some sort of hardship and losing a loved one or seeing them in the hospital. And now we see this new Delta variant actually attacking children, at least in America. It's been doing it in India for a little while already. And so, you know, I want to do at least my part, and I hope a lot of enough people are able to look it up, see my videos and realize, listen, these vaccines, they're incredibly safe. You do want to speak to your physician first if you, you know, just to make sure that your particular, you know, makeup is all right. But overall, these are incredibly safe vaccines, and they will definitely save lives, not your, just yours, but other people as well.
Without a doubt. Drew Comments, that is his handle on YouTube. You can search for him there. I will post the other handles like SJS856 on Twitter, on the blog, where I will post the video, the YouTube itself, so you can share that, because everybody needs to see and hear this, because it is that good and it's that convincing. Drew, it's great to meet you. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Great to meet you. You take care.
Likewise.
All right.
Take care.
Bye-bye. What a cool guy. You know how much I love that video. So it's, I'm so glad we were able to work that out. You know, when I first contacted him, I forgot that I had Julie Brown scheduled to come on at the bottom of the hour. And so I originally, so when he wrote me back, he's like, yeah, I can do 5:30, 2:30. And I was like, oh shit, I got to reschedule. So I'm glad he could accommodate me too, because, you know, the whole thing with Jeffrey Epstein, now it's a whole different kind of horrific, right? We, you know, so Julie K. Brown, yeah, it's funny. Someone said, oh, you have downtown Julie Brown? You just had Mark Goodman on Friday. Well, no, different. Not downtown Julie Brown. No, we did the MTV thing on Friday because yesterday was the 40th anniversary of MTV. But that's done now. This Julie Brown is Julie K. Brown, and she is a reporter for the Miami Herald. And she's the one who really broke the Jeffrey Epstein story. And what's weird is it was sort of out there in plain sight anyway. We all knew who Jeffrey Epstein was and what he was guilty of. But there was like a super secret deal cut with him by the then South Florida U.S. Attorney's Office. And it was, what's his name? Alex Acosta, who went on to become, believe it or not, the labor secretary under Donald Trump. I mean, this stuff, I couldn't make up if I tried. It's just too weird, but that whole story is that weird. So we will get into it with Julie K. Brown at the bottom of the hour. Before we get there, though, a few other things. I guess while we're on the subject of COVID, I should mention, as I told Drew, you know, I'm down here in Florida and I know. And
we're number one, damn it.
Yeah. So Florida has more COVID than any other place in the nation. We broke every record this weekend. Our governor, moron death sentence, is just, and he's like bragging on it. Seriously. This is moron death sentence this weekend.
We say no to lockdowns. No to school closures, no to restrictions, and no mandates.
Really? Oh, my God. I have another. Like, I've got a six-minute clip here.
I'm nervous. What? That could cause some problems, especially, you know, for those of us that have, like, younger ones at home, too.
Which directs the Florida...
Just to give you an idea of what comes out of this man's mouth.
Emergency rules protecting the rights of parents to make this decision about wearing masks for their children.
How do you...
In Florida, the 2020-21 school year, that...
You know what? I'm not even going to play him because he lies. Everything out of his mouth is like his mentor, his idol, Dump. He lies about everything. And why he's being touted as, you know, the Republicans 2024 hopeful if Donald Trump doesn't run. The whole thing is just so back-ass words, it doesn't make any sense. But that's who we're dealing with. That's who we're dealing with here in Florida. And now we have, you know, the highest incidence of COVID hospitalizations are through the roof. Let me play for you. Now, Dan Gelber is the mayor of Miami Beach. And thankfully, Dan Gelber ripped DeSantis or Death Sentence, a new one.
Governor has made it as difficult as possible to make people safe. He's like the Pied Piper just leading everybody off a cliff right now by letting them know that they don't have to like the CDC, they don't have to wear masks, and they can do whatever they want when we're in the midst of a enormous pandemic.
You think? So I live in Broward County. So down here in South Florida, there's Miami-Dade County, which is Miami, and, you know, Little Havana and all that. And just north of Miami-Dade County is Broward County that encompasses Fort Lauderdale and, you know, where I live, Coral Springs and everything in between. The Broward County School Board had a meeting that got quite contentious last week. A lot of, you know, flat earthers showed up protesting and stopped the meeting. But eventually the Broward County School Board ruled that when schools are back in session, I think they start in like 2 or 3 weeks, that masks will be required kindergarten through grade 12. So that happened during the week. So on Friday night, Saturday, Friday, DeSantis gives a speech and he says, in Florida, there will be no lockdown. There will be no school closures. There will be no restrictions and no mandates in the state of Florida. When are people going to wise up? Somebody send him Drew's a video, please. I would, but I don't have any friends in the governor's office. Yeah, yeah. The numbers are pretty incredible. Let me see if I've got them here. Okay. Florida on Sunday set a record for hospitalizations out of the whole pandemic. 10,207 people confirmed to have COVID-19 in the hospital in Florida. The previous record was last July 23rd, 2020. More than 6 months before vaccines were made available. That was the last record, and I don't have the number, but it was lower than the 10,207 that are hospitalized right now in the state of Florida. On Saturday, Florida set a new record for new coronavirus cases with 21,683 infections confirmed in a 24-hour period. And they tell us Florida now has more hospitalizations than any other states. And yet Ron DeSantis says, school districts can't make your students wear masks because that would be child abuse? Yeah. No. Why does anybody listen to this man? He is a fucking moron.
Everything you thought you knew, you never knew it all. Sideways is straight ahead. Facts no longer matter. Reality is now fiction. There's a signpost up ahead. Your next stop, Opposite World.
Just thought I'd say. All right, couple of other big news items while we await our next guest. Number one being the Senate stayed in session all weekend and they hammered out a bill. So the so-called bipartisan infrastructure framework is now the bipartisan so-called infrastructure bill. So it's the BIB instead of the BIF, I suppose. Chucky says they're going to vote on it before they go on break, and they are in session through the end of this week. Though they did stay in all, you know, weekend long. But a number of things happened, or didn't happen, I suppose. What didn't happen was an extension of the eviction moratorium. Now, the eviction moratorium had been put in place by the Centers for Disease Control, and the Supreme Court during the term said they didn't rule on it specifically, but raised questions about the CDC's ability to do such a thing. Well, today, the Biden administration says the Centers for Disease Control does not have the authority to extend the eviction moratorium for even another month, let alone till the end of the year. And Congress left without doing anything about it. And, well, here's, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was on one of the Sunday shows yesterday. What did she say about it?
The House and House leadership had the opportunity to vote to extend the moratorium. And there were many, and there was frankly a handful of conservative Democrats in the House that threatened to get on planes rather than hold this vote. And we have to really just call a spade. We cannot, in good faith, blame the Republican Party when House Democrats have a majority. Now, there is something to be said for the fact that this court order came down on the White House a month ago, and the White House waited until the day before the House adjourned to release a statement asking on Congress to extend the moratorium. This came after weeks. I sit on the Financial Services Committee, which has jurisdiction over housing. We had, you know, the housing secretary there asking about the administration's stance. We asked the Biden administration about their stance, and they were not being really forthright about that advocacy and that request until the day before the House adjourned. And so the House was put into a, I believe, a needlessly difficult situation. And it's not just me saying that. Financial Services Chairwoman Maxine Waters has made that very clear as well. And so there's a couple of contributing factors here. We have governors who are also not getting this emergency rental assistance out in time, which is forcing this extension, what we would like, an extension of the moratorium. The fact of the matter is that the problem is here. The House should reconvene and call this vote and extend the moratorium. There's about 11 million people that are behind on their rent at risk of eviction. That's one out of every six renters in the United States.
So that was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I believe, on Face the Nation this weekend. And she's making a good point. The one thing that it was left out of that clip is the fact that in one of the previous relief packages, there was something like $425 million allocated for renters and landlord relief. And still to this point, less than 10% of that money has been doled out. So millions of people, possibly as early as today, are getting eviction notices around the country because the moratorium has now expired, when the money should be there to help them. And frankly, I don't know whose fault it is that it's not taken care of. I guess it goes to each individual state. Now, here in Florida, or, you know, Florida, as I call it, we have Ron DeSantis, who seems more concerned with making sure, you know, our children don't wear masks when they return to school next week, then, or the week after, then he is with, you know, being concerned about the fact that some of these children, you know, might be out on the streets pretty soon too. He's got his priorities back asswards along with everything else. So that's disturbing. And then the other thing that, you know, AOC was sounding an alarm on is about this bill. So the House, the House is out. The Senate released the language for the so-called bipartisan bill, but there's still the question of the other one, the Democratic bill, the one that's going to be passed through budget reconciliation. And here's what AOC said about that. Whoops, that's the wrong one. About this.
You have called out Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema for saying she does not support the budget reconciliation package, $3.5 trillion for all sorts of priorities. You wrote, quote, good luck tanking your own party's investment on child care, climate action and infrastructure. Wow. While presuming you'll survive a three vote House margin.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. This is a deal. And we have a tight margin in the Senate. I respect that we have to get Senator, you know, Sinema and Manchin's vote on reconciliation. They should also respect that there's a very tight House margin and that we have to be able to uphold our end of the bargain as well. And House progressives are also part of that majority. And
how many House progressives do you think are with you on this?
I believe a very large amount of the progressive caucus. The total amount is about 90. I am not the whip of the progressive caucus, but what I can tell you is that it's certainly more than three. And it is in the double digits, absolutely.
Enough to prevent it from passing.
More than enough.
And then he tries to press her a little further.
So when it comes to the infrastructure package, you disagree with your fellow Democrat, Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan, who told Politico, quote, strike while the iron's hot. If you get a deal and if it's significant money, don't let it sit. It does not age well. You disagree.
Well, we have a deal, and the deal is reconciliation for the bipartisan infrastructure bill.
Okay, yeah, you've made your point.
She made her point. Thank you, Jake Tapper. Thank you, AOC. All right, let's change gears. as you know, I live here in South Florida. And it was about, I want to say 2 years ago, that the Miami Herald started running this series of articles written by our guest, Julie K. Brown, about Jeffrey Epstein. And now Julie K. Brown is out with a book also called Perversion of Justice, the Jeffrey Epstein Story. Julie K. Brown, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's
my... Can you hear me okay?
I hear you just fine.
Good.
I hear you fine. Yeah, you know, first of all, thank you for writing this. This is the weirdest story in that it almost seems it happened in plain sight. I mean, we knew that he was a bad guy. We knew that there were cases out there, but it seemed like nobody in the media had picked up the ball and run with it until you. Do you know why?
Well, it had been written about over the years. It's just that I think that a lot of people had, number one, forgotten about it. And number two, the fact that Epstein was able to just pick up with his life and go about, you know, the same kind of jet setting that he did before, just boggled my mind. So I felt that it needed to be looked at from a different vantage point. And over the years, there was a lot of new information that had been buried in either court documents or even had been sealed by judges over the years. And so my effort was to sort of take a whole new look at this story from the very beginning.
So when you really got a hold of it, Jeffrey Epstein had already served, I hate to call it a sentence, the sweetheart deal that he was inexplicably given by Alex Acosta, who at the time was the U.S. attorney in South Florida, that basically gave him a very short jail term, but allowed him to leave every day at, a car and driver pick him up and take him to an office where he spent 12 hours of each day, allowed to do whatever he wanted, have visitors, conduct business, and then he went back and slept in the jail. This doesn't sound like anybody that I know, especially a convicted rapist, any kind of sentence I've ever heard of before.
Well, the sad part about this whole thing was that he wasn't a convicted rapist because he got out of the crime. Essentially, the prosecutors, but first the state prosecutors in Palm Beach, and then the federal prosecutors treated these victims as if they were prostitutes, even though they were 13, 14 years old. And because of that, they minimized the scope of Epstein's crimes by calling it, you know, it's just a simple prostitution case, as opposed to pointing out that, by the way, there were 34 girls, and this was a whole recruiting operation in which he used fraud and coercion to get these girls to the place where they were molested. He didn't offer them money for sex. He offered them money to give him a massage. And when you're 13, 14 years old, in their minds, they had no idea
what
many
that meant.
Of them, what was going to happen.
That's astounding. So you came to the story really after it was done, after his sentence was over. What made you decide to go back and examine it?
Well, sort of looking at doing a new project, and I thought I would do it on sex trafficking in Florida. And every time I did some research on that, Jeffrey Epstein's name kept coming up.
Wow.
And the more I looked at it, the more I thought, how did he get away with this? And I set about really taking it like a cold case detective, taking the case apart. You know, it was over a decade old. And one of the first things I noticed was that these victims had never been we didn't know who they were, and no one had ever spoken to them. So when President Trump nominated Alex Acosta in 2017 to be his leader, I was aware that Acosta was the Miami prosecutor back then that signed off on this sweetheart deal for Epstein. So at that point, when he was, confirmed as labor secretary, I wondered what the victims thought of this. Now they're in their late 20s. And this is a man who let their predator off the hook, who now oversees an agency that has a responsibility for human trafficking and child labor laws. So I felt that it was timely to take a new look at the case.
So, but it wasn't easy to do because most of these women were minors. They were children, in fact, at the time the crimes were committed. So they were referred to as like Jane Doe number one through whatever. So right. You had to then find out who they were. How did you go about doing that?
Well, it was a lot harder than I thought it was going to be. It was a long time ago. You know, there's not really computer records from mm-hmm. back then. And so it was all paper that I had to look at. And I just had to read everything that I could find on it, because inevitably when they redact things out of court documents or public records, they often forget to redact a name or two here or there. Uh-huh. I had no intention of revealing the names of any of these women without their permission, but I had to find them. So I just started, if I found one name or I found a date of birth and a last name, sometimes I could find their, maybe this is a parent's name is mentioned, for example, then I could kind of research the parent and find out who the daughter was.
Right.
I used social media pages to help. Epstein had this certain look of a girl that he liked, small, petite, blonde, blue-eyed, waif-like looking girl. So once I found a few of them, I was able to find more, because inevitably on their Facebook page, they were friends with other girls that looked similar to them. So, that was a painstaking process.
So, but it's interesting. You describe that's his type, blonde, blue-eyed, waif-like. That doesn't describe his alleged girlfriend, Ghislaine Maxwell, does it? She's not his type? What is their deal?
Well, he wasn't with her to be really his lover.
Right.
She was with him. He took advantage of her social connections. She, came from society in Britain, moved to the United States when her father, who was a publishing magnate, mysteriously vanished off of his yacht in the Canary Islands, years and years ago. And so the family was mired in scandal because he had stolen a lot of money from the employees pension fund of the companies that he owned. So in any event, she moved to New York to escape the scandal and build a whole new image here in New York as this social butterfly who came to know a lot of very wealthy, famous people. And at the time she knew Epstein from her father, and became friends, and she helped introduce him to the right people.
Wow. And talk about, changing your life. I guess she did. We're speaking with Julie K. Brown. She's a Miami Herald reporter. We get the Herald here every day. And I remember reading these articles as they came out a few years ago. I actually attempted to get you on the show back then, and our paths kept crossing. It never worked. So I'm glad to finally meet you today. The book is out. It's called Perversion of Justice, and you run the whole through the whole investigation, which just is a really disturbing story. This must have played games with your head. I can't imagine getting so deep into this really skeezy, ugly world and it not affecting your psyche a little bit.
Well, I've been a journalist for a very long time, 30 years, and I've always covered crime and human rights issues and difficult topics. I talk to a lot of journalism students about this, and I will say that probably everything I did in my career prepared me to handle this story, because it would have been very difficult, 20 years for me, I think, to do a story like this. But I had just come off a series, very disturbing series, about Florida prisons and how inmates essentially are killed in Florida prisons and abused very badly. So I had been sort of, battle tested on difficult topics. That said, this was probably the most difficult and challenging story in my career. I had a videographer, fortunately, reporting partner, Emily Michaud, from the very gifted, photographer and videographer, who came with me on these interviews.
Okay.
I think we sort of supported each other, on our good days and our bad.
So we talked about you track down a lot of these now women who were girls when this happened to them. And then you had to somehow get them to trust you, to talk to you, to open up to you about what happened. In the end, how many victims do we know that there were, and how many people did you ultimately speak with?
Well, now we know, because a lot more have come forward, although they're not all public, that there were over 100, well over 100, and probably possibly even more than 200.
Wow.
At the time, however, we only knew initially that there were 34 women who were named as defendants in this, as victims as part of this FBI investigation back in 2008. But I tracked down, what I should say is I was able to identify 60 initially.
Wow.
And I tried to reach out to them in many different ways. And I sort of go through all the steps that I took, and including the missteps that I took. I think, you know, a lot of people think of journalism as, you know, you're exposing this and you're exposing that. But a lot of journalism is hitting walls, you know, and, you know, it's a lot of it is failure more than it's success. And that's a little bit about what this book is about, too. All the, you know, the different challenges that journalists face when they're going after a story like this, which involves a lot of very influential, wealthy people who don't want you to really write the story.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure, without a doubt. And so, okay, so you do it and you talk to them. And what you learned is, well, what you knew before you even went looking for them, that when this sweetheart deal was being made with Jeffrey Epstein, usually when there are victims, they are kept abreast of any developments in the case. They're consulted before a deal is cut, I believe. None of that happened here. And you said these girls had not been told anything. The ones who came forward and told their stories, they were just as in the dark as those who never did?
That's correct. They went to great. In fact, part of what I learned through this investigation wasn't just that they kept this from the victims, which was illegal in of itself, because there's a federal law that requires prosecutors to do certain things involving victims. And one of them is to at least let them appear at the plea hearing, tell them it's going to happen. They never did that. But worse than that, almost to me, was the fact that you could see that Epstein's attorneys and the prosecutors together went to great lengths to make sure that the victims and their lawyers and their families didn't find out. So in my mind, I mean, that essentially was a cover-up. They essentially did not want, they also didn't tell the judge when he had his hearing. They didn't tell the judge exactly how many victims there were. And, you know, the prosecutors even misled the judge into thinking that this was just one or two girls when it wasn't. And so that was even more stunning, I think, to learn that here were prosecutors who were supposed to work on behalf of victims, essentially working hand in hand with Epstein's lawyers.
Did you ever determine why that was? Like, was there money involved? Was Alex Acosta implicated? I mean, obviously he's the one who made the call, and then he goes on to become labor secretary under Trump, which is just more, you know, mind-blowing, unbelievable turn of events. Was it because Jeffrey Epstein and Trump go way back and were friends, or do we know?
We really don't know. The bigger problem, which I go over in my book, is that it's almost as if the Justice Department doesn't want to know, because there is always a way to find out the answers to those questions. But it doesn't appear that they were willing to dig far enough to find out. One of the things, for example, they did do an investigation and they learned that Alex Acosta's emails during the critical time period when this negotiation was happening, they're gone.
Oh, now, how interesting.
How does that happen? Right there, that's an issue. And so this is a story that has so many holes in it from, you know, the very beginning. That's the very reason why people distrust their government. And the very reason why there are so many conspiracy theories out about this case, because authorities haven't seen fit to be more transparent or to dig deeply enough to find answers.
Wow. And so now it's been a couple of years since Jeffrey Epstein's arrest, since your series in the Herald broke. Now Ghislaine Maxwell is behind bars and under heavy watch. We were told that about a month after he was incarcerated, Jeffrey Epstein committed suicide. You don't believe that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't have people look at it when I say that, like, oh, what do you know? When did you know? And all that. I don't have any, you know, insider kind of information, but I just think it's common sense to look at some of these things and to think that doesn't, you know, that doesn't really make any sense. For example, you know, you have not one guard, but two guards.
Right.
The video is gone. This cellmate who was supposed to be monitoring him because he just got off a suicide watch, and part of the policy was you always have a cellmate when someone gets out of suicide watch to keep an eye on him. The cellmate is taken out and he's transferred to a facility, by the way, that's for informants. It's for informants. The cellmate, by the way, now is dead of COVID, so we can't really ask him.
Oh my God.
You know, and then they had a, the family hired a noted forensic pathologist named Dr. Michael Bodden to be at the autopsy. And
yes,
he found that there were three bones broken in Epstein's neck. Now, Epstein was not a big guy, okay? And they were trying to say that he hung himself from his top bunk using some sheets. Yet they cut him down. They removed the body before anybody could take pictures to confirm that. And, you know, as Bodden said, there was not enough velocity there for him to use the force that would have been necessary to break three bones in his neck. It was more likely that he had been strangled. Now, whether it was assisted suicide, it very well might have been. Maybe he did want to go. But everything that I know about Epstein, he felt he was above the law.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was much too soon in the process for him, in my opinion, to throw in the towel, because he had just, he lost his bail hearing, but as he was hiring lawyers left and right the week before this happened. So there's just many things that don't make any sense as far as it being a suicide.
Are you convinced that he's dead?
Yeah, I'm convinced he's dead.
Okay.
Yes, I'm pretty convinced.
I just have this thought of like Ken Lay and other people like that being on some island somewhere, you know, just laughing, living the good life.
Well, Bodden was at the autopsy, so I feel confident.
Okay.
I've worked with Dr. Bodden before in some of my prison stories. And he, not only that, but the other interesting thing about Bodden is he was on the New York State Prison I don't know what it's called, but it's a board that they have that investigate nothing but prison deaths.
Oh, wow.
So he has a lot of expertise in prison deaths.
I remember his name going back decades. I used to live in New York as well, and he was the celebrity medical examiner. He's the big gun that everybody brought in. So if Michael Bodden was on the case, you knew that it went to the highest level. So, all right. So Julie Brown. So here we are. Epstein dies before victims can get their day in court or get any restitution or anything. But obviously there were a lot of properties. There was a lot of money there. It was being sold off. And was money being distributed to the victims? What's the status of that?
Yeah, the victims have collected millions and millions of dollars. I can't recall the number. I have it in my book, but and it might even be higher now. There have been over 100 women that I know of at last count who have been able to collect money from this fund. The only problem with this is that they, you know, by doing this, they really don't have to go public, you know.
Uh-huh.
So we might never know the names of other people that were involved in this. You know, Epstein did not do this by himself. He had a lot of people around him that were helping him or were complicit or at the very least knew what he was doing and looked the other way. And we might never know who all those people were because, understandably, these victims don't want to go public. The few victims that have been raped, you know, in public by people like Alan Dershowitz. And so they're not going, they don't want to subject, it's not even just subjecting themselves to this, it's subjecting their whole families to this. And that's what Epstein's MO was. You know, I go into detail in my book about how much they tore apart these girls' lives. And it's amazing that the prosecutors never put a stop to it. They let them follow these girls and go into where they worked and put headlights on at night on their houses, running a father off the road. I mean, it's like a nightmare.
That's amazing. It's just horrific. And are the names of the, we know Alex Acosta, but what about the other ones? What about the state's attorney or district attorney in Palm Beach County? What about the others, New York? I mean, there's been stuff all over the place. Others who have let him slip through the cracks or maybe helped him get a sweetheart deal. Do we know those names?
We do. I have named some of them in my book. You know, we know, for example, that Cy Vance, attorney general in New York, at one point went and sent a prosecutor into court to argue to lower his sex offender status, which would have given him more freedom to not follow some of the sex offender laws in New York. Fortunately, the judge saw through what was happening and prevented it from occurring. But those were the kind of, even after all this happened, Epstein was relentless in trying to get away with anything and everything.
Wow. So, okay, so now the one still outstanding part of this all is Maxwell, Ghislaine Maxwell, who is in jail, going to go to trial. So what's going to happen with her? What is the story with her?
Well, she's awaiting trial on some very serious charges, sex trafficking. And I know that one of the victims, most people I think in the media are aware who one of the victims are, but we're protecting her identity until she chooses to go public. But she was somebody that was on the inside, in the internal orbit of Jeffrey Epstein's life, who flew on his planes, who watched this whole thing. So it will be interesting if and when it comes to trial, what happens, and if she testifies publicly, or, you know, maybe they'll figure out a way to do it where they can shield her somewhat. But she's going to be a very interesting witness. For now, you know, Ghislaine is taking a page out of the Jeffrey Epstein playbook in that, you know, she's hiring a whole battery of very costly and connected lawyers. People who worked in the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York previously. Her family has hired a PR sort of machine to produce videos, which they've put on social media, pleading that, you know, she should be innocent until proven guilty, that kind of thing. So she's also, they're filing briefs after briefs after briefs. You know, that was one of the things that happened in the Epstein case. In a way, they wore these prosecutors down because they would file, you know, 50-page briefs. And, you know, you have to look at every single argument they put out there, and then you got to put a counter argument.
Right.
You can waste, you know, weeks and weeks buried in legal, you know, mumbo jumbo, so to speak. So, you know, she's got, you know, the best defense that money can buy, as they say.
Is there even a trial set, or is it just getting through all these challenges?
There's a trial set for late November right now.
Okay.
I think she wants to get it over with because, she, as most people probably have heard, she's complaining bitterly about her prison conditions in the Brooklyn Metropolitan Center, I think. And, she's unhappy just like anybody else who would be in jail. You know, jail is not a pleasant place. And so she's I don't think she wants to stay in there one more day than she has to, you know? So I think she really wants to go to trial and get it over with.
Yeah. Well, and then, you know, hopefully she'll be there for the rest of her life, or at least in a more long-term facility. Cause I can't see her walking from this because someone's got to pay. And I guess she's the only one left. Now, what about the other people. You mentioned Alan Dershowitz, but there's Bill Clinton, there's Donald Trump, there's Prince Andrew, there's others who have been on the island, on the plane, the Lolita Express, things like that. Did they all get off scot-free? Are any of them being questioned about what they were doing on the plane or on the island?
It's hard to know. Federal prosecutors are notoriously pretty tight-lipped about their cases, and they're not subject to a lot of the public records laws that other state authorities in Florida, for example, would be subject to. So we don't really know exactly how deep they're investigating, but I'm hopeful that they're not going to stop it, Maxwell. And I know his victims do not want prosecutors to stop at just going after Maxwell. They want everybody who is responsible to be held accountable.
Now, I do know that some have specifically pointed to Prince Andrew and Alan Dershowitz and said that they were told by Jeffrey Epstein to service those men. Were the others? I mean, are there specific allegations against, say, Trump and Clinton?
Not that I know of, but that doesn't mean that, no. You know, some of these women that went to collect on his estate didn't have experiences with other men. But we don't really know. I haven't anyway heard of anybody who has made allegations of that nature against either Clinton or Trump.
Okay. Well, I guess there's still a lot more to unfold. And maybe in November, do you think we'll see it go to trial in November? Or you think it's going to be pushed off a bit longer?
It's hard to know. She is mounting a very fierce defense, and they might need more time because they added another victim in the middle of a couple of months ago. So they have more, information to gather. So it's hard to know. But as I said, she doesn't want to stay in jail. So I'm sure she wants to, have her day in court sooner than later.
Right. Well, okay, good. I hope she gets it. I hope she gets it. And I hope we can all get some closure on this, especially the girls who were victimized. Is there a movie in the works? Anybody optioned the book yet?
Yeah, it's been optioned by Adam McKay, the director, and his company, as well as HBO. So,
oh, wow.
They're working on a script.
Awesome. And Julie K. Brown, you are a reporter for the Miami Herald. New ownership there. How are things? Is it going to be okay?
Oh, gosh, define okay. Yeah. I mean, the journalism business is just...
It's like the radio business.
Yeah, it's tough. It's really tough. And you have to love doing this. You have to have a passion for it outside of the business, because otherwise, I mean, you just can't survive if you don't love writing and reporting and writing injustices and things like that, because the business is not a healthy one to be in.
No, it's not. And McClatchy was such a respected company. And now you've been taken over by a hedge fund, basically, isn't it? Yeah.
So. Yeah. And with all newspapers around the country, they're all blind because of that. I mean, what I would like to say finally is buy your local newspaper, because, I don't think a lot of people understand how important it is to your community and how important it is to our democracy, because these are reporters that live in your neighborhood and in your community, and they want to find out how your money is spent or being misspent. And if you don't have that resource anymore, you're not going to know what is happening next door or in City Hall.
Exactly. And you know what? I saw it happen with radio, where radio was all centralized now since 1996, the Telecommunications Act. I have a 40-year radio career. And obviously now I'm broadcasting from my home studio over the internet because my industry was destroyed. And it's sad what's happening with newspapers now. And the FCC or the Supreme Court just agreed to these ownership rules that now one company can not only own 8 or more radio stations in a market, they can also own multiple newspapers, which is not, it doesn't showcase a number of different voices and opinions. That's not the purpose of it. It defeats the purpose. So Julie K. Brown, I'm glad you're out there doing the work. Thank you so much for reporting on this story, because it's obviously information we need to know. And thank you for the book. It's called Perversion of Justice, the Jeffrey Epstein Story. It is out now. Julie K. Brown, great to meet you. Thank you again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. You take care. Great to meet you. Bye-bye. All right. And with that, we are done for a Monday. It's a Monday. Tomorrow's Tuesday. Gotta Laugh will be here because it's every other Tuesday. All right. And I guess that does it. We made it through a Monday, but barely. Things are crazy out there. Oh, and one more cop, one more Capitol Police officer who defended the Capitol on January 6th killed himself. This is not over, and it's not okay. All right, I will leave you with the news because we can, and I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everyone. I read the news
today, oh boy. It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The so-called Bipartisan Infrastructure Framework, BIF, is now a BIB, as the bill with the actual title of the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, all 2,702 pages of it, was released Sunday night. There's tens of billions of dollars in there for all the traditional areas of infrastructure spending, roads, highways, bridges, rail, and airports, as well as funding for broadband, updates to the nation's power grid, combating climate change, clean energy research, and electric vehicle charging stations. And Amtrak gets a huge boost too, the most in decades. Chuck Schumer reiterated his plan to also pass a roughly $3.5 trillion budget resolution sought by Democrats before the August recess. In fact, progressive Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez appeared on CNN to reiterate that there is a deal to get both bills done.
So when it comes to the infrastructure package, you disagree with your fellow Democrat, Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan, who told Politico, quote, strike while the iron's hot. If you get a deal and if it's significant money, don't let it sit. It does not age well. You disagree.
Well, we have a deal, and the deal is reconciliation for the bipartisan infrastructure bill.
Okay. Yeah, you've made your point.
Moving on to COVID.
We're number one, damn it!
Florida on Sunday set a record for coronavirus hospitalizations with 10,207 people confirmed to have COVID-19 currently hospitalized. The previous record was set on July 23, 2020, more than 6 months before vaccines were widely available. The state also set a daily record for new coronavirus cases this weekend, with 21,683 infections confirmed on Saturday. Florida now has more hospitalizations per capita than any other state. But our governor, Ron DeSantis, has resisted mask and vaccine mandates, and Florida's Republican-controlled legislature is backing him up.
We say no to lockdowns, no to school closures, no to restrictions, and no mandates.
Just in case you were wondering why I call it Florida.
I'll be signing an executive order which directs the Florida Department of Education and Department of Health to issue emergency rules protecting the rights of parents to make this decision about wearing masks for their children.
That happened after a number of school districts, including Broward County, instituted mask mandates for the coming school year. This should go well. At least we have some good elected officials down here. Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gelber ripped DeSantis as the Pied Piper of COVID-19, who was, quote, leading everybody off a cliff. Meanwhile, the pandemic-related federal ban on evictions expired Saturday night, despite a, well, tepid last-minute effort from the House Democrats to extend the deadline. Speaker Nancy Pelosi indicated she was caught off guard by Joe Biden's call for Congress to act and was unable to corral the votes necessary or pass it via unanimous consent before the House adjourned for a seven-week-long recess. Yeah, you heard that right. A seven-week-long recess? Now? The Senate was in session Saturday but did not address the issue. Congresswoman Cori Bush of Missouri slept outside the Capitol this weekend to try to convince Congress to return while protesters gathered outside of Nancy Pelosi's home in San Francisco and even taped a fake eviction notice to her door. Reuters is reporting that more than 15 million people in 6.5 million U.S. households are behind on their rent. This would be a good time to point out that there's upwards of $425 million allocated to help out renters and landlords, yet less than 10% of it has been distributed. What are they waiting for? Rhetorical question, but an answer would be nice. The 2020 Olympics continue in Tokyo. The big news on Monday is that a Belarusian sprinter entered the Polish embassy in Tokyo and defected. This after she refused to board a flight home, saying she feared for her safety if she returned to Belarus. The runner, Kristina Timanovskaya, her offense, criticizing the coaches on Instagram. Seriously. The Belarusian National Olympic Committee said it had pulled her from the games due to her, quote, emotional and psychological state. Oh, boy. The committee is run by Viktor Lukashenko, who's the eldest son of the Belarus strongman leader, Alexander Lukashenko, who is known for stifling dissent. And we will get to see Simone Biles compete in one event at the Olympics. The gymnast announced that she plans to return for Tuesday's final in the balance beam. She said that's the one apparatus that is not affected by what she describes as the twisties, a block that's keeping her from being able to determine up from down. Firefighters on Sunday made progress against Southern Oregon's massive bootleg fire. It's the largest of the 91 wildfires burning in the U.S., as of Sunday, officials said the fire, which was started nearly a month ago by a lightning strike, is now 74% contained. In Northern California's Plumas National Forest, the Dixie Fire was just 32% contained on Sunday. That fire has already destroyed 42 homes and lots of other buildings. Scientists say that because of climate change, the western U.S. is hotter and drier, making fire more destructive. And there's just one day left before a special election that both the moderate Democratic establishment and the progressive left see as a referendum on the future of the Democratic Party. In Ohio, former state senator Nina Turner is facing off against Cuyahoga County Council member Chantel Brown to represent Ohio's 11th congressional district, filling the seat vacated by Marsha Fudge when she was tapped to be Joe Biden's Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is totally listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.